This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Our justice system is sometimes referred to as retributive justice. Somebody commits a crime, we catch them and punish them, and then we say they paid their debt to society. But have they satisfied the needs of the victim? Most states require some sort of restitution for their material loss, but the fear and insecurity caused by the crime goes unaddressed, and offenders never are asked to acknowledge their guilt or the full impact of their crime. Now imagine a system where the focus is on restoring what has been lost, to repair the harm to everyone involved. In short, where the focus is on the victim. What would that look like? Well, it might look like restorative justice. Fred Van Loo is director of the Center for Restorative Justice Practices. He's a former prosecutor based in Des Moines, Iowa, and he joins us now. Fred, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Frank. That was a great introduction about restorative justice.
So have I said it all? What more needs to be said about what restorative justice is?
I think that's it.
And who participates in this? Or I should ask you, you're a prosecutor or were a prosecutor in Des Moines, in Polk County, in Iowa. How did you find out about restorative justice, and why did you as a prosecutor think that that's something that Polk County needed?
Well, good questions. I graduated from law school in 83 and served as just a trial prosecutor for a couple of years, and then did legal aid work for a while. And then in 91 was asked by a new elected prosecutor to take over managing the Criminal Bureau. And it seemed somewhat overwhelming. The numbers were incredible. But about 6 months into that job, I got a letter from a good friend of mine, a local minister, and telling me about restorative justice. And he included in a packet of information the keynote address by someone in Ontario, Canada, at their annual restorative justice conference. And the light bulb went on, and it just made so much sense. And I had experienced, in my first 8 or 10 years as a lawyer, victims being dissatisfied with the system. They would want the person who'd committed the crime, who'd harmed them, to go to prison, and they thought that that would solve everything. And then I would hear from them later, and there was something missing, but they really couldn't articulate what it was. And then when restorative justice came along for me in 1991, the pieces sort of fell in place. And what they wanted was what many of us want when we've been hurt. They want to be able to talk about it, and let the person who caused the harm know what it was like to be hurt. And then they'd like to have an apology, an expression of remorse if possible. And so, pretty simple human stuff, but the system doesn't allow for that normally.
Well, that's right, because it is the state versus the offender in that case. So my crime is literally taken away from me. I was offended, but now I don't have it anymore. I've given it to the state. They're taking it away.
That's right. So the victim has no legal standing, as we say.
So how does this mediation or restorative justice process take place? What does it look like?
There are different different manifestations of restorative justice, and so the meeting with a victim and an offender is one, and it's perhaps sort of the most common one, but it's one of several processes. But it's the one I'm most familiar with and most comfortable and see the most transformation in. And so what you have is you have a small conference room, private. You have a trained facilitator who's trained not only as a mediator facilitator, but also hopefully they're trained to have some understanding of restorative justice principles. And they sit on either side of the table with a facilitator at the end. And generally, at least it's my practice, has been for 20-some years, to defer to the victim and just allow them to talk about what happened, the day or the evening of the crime. And talk about the impact of the crime on them, how it affected them, their family, their sense of security. You mentioned that in your intro. And that's a huge thing, the loss of security. And if it's somebody that they knew and had in a trusted position, hopefully they'll get to, and over a period of time I anticipated they would get to what it was like to be betrayed. Whoever talks about betrayal in the criminal justice system, but that's a huge thing for victims who are harmed by someone they know. It could be an employee, could be even by a family member or a relative or a neighbor or whatever. This experience of having been betrayed, and uh,
And it starts with the victim. You begin by asking the victim if they want to participate. So it's all up to them right from the start. Is that right?
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. In our system here in Polk County, Iowa, Des Moines, the capital, it took us a few years, but by the mid-90s, we were able to convince the judicial system here to put in every criminal sentencing order a paragraph so that if there was a victim, the offender had to meet with the victim, if the victim wanted the meeting, to talk about the impact of the crime. And so it really all starts with the victim and having them understand, you know, and most people don't, why would I want to meet with an offender, the person that hurt me?
Right.
So you have a discussion about that.
But it's interesting that you're saying a lot of victims do. That's precisely what they want. So that's the first surprise. Why would a victim ever want to meet the person who harmed them? It turns out they do in many cases.
Oh, it turns out they do.
But right. Then the other thing is, and I can see a lot of people listening to this rolling their eyes, watching the offender hear about all of the mistrust and the fact that you've hurt me. This is in the case of a hardened criminal. Oh, yeah. So what do you want from me? An apology? Will I get off the hook? Yeah. I'm sorry. You're offended. It seems like it might be cheap grace to say to a hardened offender, well, you know, I'm feeling a little more insecure now because of what you did. What happens in that process?
Well, great question. And that's understandable that people would have those thoughts. In our county, we actually have a courtroom in the jail. And so over the years, with permission of their attorneys, I would talk to offenders who were in jail about meeting with victims. And it was no easy way out for them. In fact, many, many times they would say, you know what, I would rather stay in jail than have to meet the person I hurt. So it's not a soft-on-crime thing. And it's not a replacement either. It's not an alternative system as such, although there are many people in the field think that it could be someday. But it is not an alternative. It's an additional process that addresses issues that the system by way of our Constitution does not address.
And you had an early experience with this. Maybe it was your first experience that had to do with vandalism at a synagogue. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Not quite the first. We first started doing these in 1991, but I think this was in 1994. And there was I think Des Moines has three Jewish synagogues. And one of them, they woke up in the morning and the entire west side of the synagogue had been defaced in a very severe way with spray-painted Nazi slogans and defamations of the Jewish tradition. And, you know, the city of Des Moines was outraged, and rightly so. Different faith traditions rallied around the rabbi and the synagogue generally. And so that was a really good thing, but sort of a byproduct with that, or simultaneous with this, was this sort of lynch mob mentality, sort of rose, you know, and we're going to get whoever did this, we're going to get them, and we're going to lock them up for as long as we can. Well, about 2 weeks later, the two were arrested. The case came to me, and normally I would assign that kind of case to one of the attorneys I supervised, but I decided to hold on to it, thinking that there might be an opportunity for restorative justice. I called the rabbi, Rabbi Stephen Fink, who's in Baltimore now at a synagogue, and talked to him about it, and he was respectful, but he finally said, you know, we just can't do that, not in this situation. And I invited him to call me back if he ever had any questions, and he did call me back about a week later, and he said, you know, we've been meeting and talking and agonizing over this, and we've finally come to the conclusion, how can we not meet with these two people? And I had a staff person meet with the rabbi and some other members of the synagogue. And the synagogue itself selected seven people from within the congregation to participate in a meeting. Two of them were elderly Holocaust survivors. Another one had worked for the Israeli Secret Service, if I remember right. And then we talked to the defense attorneys, and they both encouraged their clients to participate in this thing. And one was 17 at the time and one was 18. It was a boyfriend-girlfriend situation. And and I can still recall it. It was in the basement of the synagogue
They had considered themselves, yeah. Forgive me for interrupting, but a kind of neo-Nazi organization, albeit an organization of two, as I understand it.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing, and this did not come out until this dialogue the evening of on this particular evening, the young man had run away from home because of abuse, ended up in, I think, Alabama, and had been taken in by a well-defined neo-Nazi organization, and actually had been indoctrinated for about a six-month period. You know, we hear about this neo-Nazi white supremacy, these underground groups and movements, and this is clearly one that he fell into. To the point that every day, and he talked to the people at the synagogue about this, that every day he was required to look at photo albums of Jewish people so that he would recognize them on the street. And so he had been clearly, deeply indoctrinated with this hate. And so he came back to Des Moines. He was from central Iowa, met up with a young woman, and decided to take things into his own hand, and that he needed to make a statement about his beliefs. And so that was why the synagogue was targeted.
All right, we're going to take a break right here, Fred. I want to hear the rest of that story. What happened when those two offenders met with the congregation, how it turned out as our conversation about restorative justice continues. I'm talking with Fred Van Loo, director of the Center of Restorative Justice Practices, former prosecutor based in Des Moines, Iowa. Just ahead, a look at restorative justice in this area, how it works or how it could work in the adult system and how it is working with young people. You'll hear it on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today we're talking about restorative justice. And on the line with us is Fred Van Loo, director of the Center of Restorative Justice Practices and a former prosecutor based in Des Moines, Iowa. And before the break, we were talking about a case he prosecuted. It was two people who were offenders in a case who had desecrated a Jewish synagogue in Des Moines and were caught. And Fred, you decided to ask the rabbi if he would enter into the restorative justice process. At first, he said no, thought about it for a while, came back to you and said, of course, we must. The group that he sent included Holocaust survivors and then these two neo-Nazi inductees, I guess you'd say, who had been very firm in their conviction and their anti-Semitism, are now in the room together. What happens?
Well, as is generally customary with any kind of a victim offender process, you defer to the victims and allow them to talk about the crime and the impact of the crime, what their response was, and it was extremely powerful, as you can imagine, with particularly the two Holocaust survivors. They had actually gone into hiding after this came out. They thought they were in their 80s. They both lived alone, and they each separately, not knowing of the other, locked themselves in their basements. They thought the Nazis had come back, and so the trauma was considerable, as it was really for the entire congregation. So each one of them spoke, about their impressions, their response, and then their each of their unique history as it related to anti-Semitism. And then one of them asked the young couple, "Tell us about yourselves." And the young man spoke more than his girlfriend, but he said at the age of 16, he ran away from home. He had a hearing problem that his stepfather would never address, and so as a result, he developed a speech impediment, and he was picked on, had been the victim of bullying, and also the victim of both emotional and physical abuse by his stepfather. And he finally ran away from home at the age of 16 and went to Alabama, as I said earlier, and became involved in the neo-Nazi ideology. And so he talked about that. The girl actually had fallen in love with him and as a result adopted his ideology. It's just fascinating when you watch these if there's truly listening going on. You know, the young people were clearly moved by what they heard from the representatives of the congregation, and the representatives of the congregation were moved by what they were hearing from these young people. And then finally, one of them said, "What do you want from us?" Meaning, you know, what do you young people, what do you want from us? And the young man said, "Well, we would really like to be forgiven." And then this was fascinating, I think. Rabbi Fink, who had not spoken much, just a very compassionate man, but had left it to the members of the congregation to speak. But he said, you know, in our tradition, you have to earn forgiveness. We have this concept called atonement. And you have to do something. You have to do something in an affirmative way. It's not just a matter of just to ask for forgiveness and be forgiven. You know, forgiveness is not a right. And so that was an incredible segue then into a discussion about what would atonement look like. And what they came up with was that each of the two had to do 200 hours of service to the synagogue, 100 hours each. Working with the chief groundskeeper who was responsible for dealing with the physical damage to the synagogue, and then 100 hours each of them meeting with the rabbi on a weekly basis over a period of time, studying Jewish and Holocaust history, and that was agreed to. In addition to that, one of the members of the synagogue took it upon herself to get the young man into a speech pathologist and get him fitted with a hearing aid. I think they both had to finish their GEDs and both had to engage in some counseling. And then there was an agreement that they would come back in 6 months and see how this had all played out. And fortunately, we had a very understanding judge who put everything on hold. He said, you know what, I'm going to see how this stuff works out in the community here. I'm in no big hurry for this case to get wrapped up if things can be made right between the synagogue and the young people. And that's exactly what happened, and they came back in 6 months. The young people had done everything. They'd become friends with the groundskeeper, the caretaker. They'd become friends with the rabbi. People were teary at this reunion. The couple actually got married, and the rabbi was not able to attend, but the synagogue sent a wedding gift to the couple. And the groundskeeper actually attended the wedding as well. Even 5 years later, I remember clearly, 5 years later, we held a restorative justice conference in Des Moines, and the police chief that was there, and then the rabbi spoke. And 5 years after this, it was still difficult for him to talk about how much impact this had on him entering into a relationship with these people and participating in this healing process.
Yeah, and how are they doing now? Do you have any idea how the –
You know, I don't. Yeah. I actually was in Baltimore this spring, met Rabbi Fink, and he still gets teary in talking about it. And I told him I'd try to track them down. I still need to do it.
You know, imagine the alternative. So if you had done it the way you were trained to do, which is to prosecute, you'd have gotten a conviction. They would have gone to jail. Those two Holocaust survivors probably would not have come out of their basement.
At least emotionally.
Emotionally. You know? The offenders would have gone to jail, ever more firm in their conviction, finding their like inside. I mean, I'm speculating, but it's not wild speculation to think that they would become worse and worse and more confirmed in that hateful thought because they thought they did the right thing and were martyrs to a cause, and see how things turned out.
Oh, I think you're right on. I think that's exactly. There's, you know, even though they were on paper first-time offenders, it would have been extremely difficult for a judge to not send them to prison given the public outcry and everything. So I think you're right on.
But to be clear, they could have gone to prison and still can. You can go through this process and then go back to the judge, and the judge can say, yeah, I'll take that into account or not. And by the way, here's your sentence.
Yeah, absolutely. In this case, the judge not only did not send them to prison, but in Iowa, and as in many states, they may use a different term, the judge actually deferred judgment. And what that means in Iowa is if you finish your probationary period, you actually do not have a conviction of record. Mm-hmm. And so they – not only did they atone as it related to the synagogue, but they really atoned as it related to the criminal justice system, to the point that a judge said, you know what, I'm going to say you never did this, you know.
Well, let's see how this might play out here in North Carolina. Joining us now is Marcia Owen. Marcia is the executive director of the Religious Coalition for a Nonviolent Durham. Marcia, good to have you back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I know that you're active in restorative justice work. You and I are working together on restorative justice, I should point out, here in Durham County. But tell us how you, because you've been doing this for a lot longer, came to see restorative justice as something that's important for this community.
Yes, I think it began with our outreach and our presence in the lives of families of homicide victims. and then just being present and listening to the harm that had been done to these families and recognizing that they're really listening to them say that they did not feel that they had a place in the criminal justice system. It was a crime against the state of North Carolina, not against this family, and yet they were devastated, broken.
But you were also very empathetic and sympathetic with these families, and at first, initially, when you became involved, angry.
At
these offenders. You've destroyed these lives, and I've come to love these people, and how could you do this?
That's right. And so, and being close to the families and listening and accompanying them to, on occasion, to meetings with the district attorney's office, sitting in sentencing hearings, recognizing that that crime really became the property of institutions. It was the property of the state of North Carolina, and it was the property of the defense attorney. It was a win-lose situation. So where is the wholeness in that? So it was inherently going to break someone's. And I saw that in the, like you said, you think, well, if a harm has been done, punish, and that will restore wholeness to the victim. Well, that didn't do it. I heard mother after mother say, I want to know what happened. And as I sat in the courtroom and listened to these cases, what was understanding was not the goal. That the whole story was not said. Like when you watch TV, it's like, oh, the entire event is revealed. Not so. So families feel lost, not valued, and left with this emptiness and this powerlessness that I think is often manifests emotionally as shame. That the community does not understand. It creates an environment of assumption.
Right.
Everybody's making assumptions. No one is really revealing the truth of what happened. And to give an apology is discouraged. People will not, even those who are guilty and plea, in, you know, when they pled guilty, there is not, there's no opening to the truth.
Right. And so the public at large responds by becoming ever more punitive. This is a horrible thing, and we, in your behalf, are outraged with you in the same way that Des Moines and any other community would be outraged at that and wants justice. So, Fred Van Loo, let me ask you if this was a tough sell, because it does seem that it when you promoted it first, when you begin to talk about it, you would be accused of being soft on crime. And did that happen? And was this difficult to get instituted along with the other system, because it doesn't replace it in Polk County?
Yeah, well, yeah, I was accused of being soft on. I was accused of being a social worker.
And, oh my God!
Which, yeah, that was as derisive a term as you could use, you know, for a prosecutor. Yeah. And you know, and so initially, for the first couple of years, it was a sort of catch as catch can. I would try to talk to defense attorneys. I'd look at a case; it seemed appropriate. I'd say, "What do you think? There's this process, and it's pretty amazing, really." And it might do your client some good. I've talked to the victim. They're willing to try it. And so for the first couple of years, we were just sort of – when we saw cases that were appropriate, we got a hold of the people and asked them, you know. And they were cases that were in the system, you know.
Right.
And then I would encourage attorneys to sit in because they were as skeptical as anybody. You know, attorneys don't want their clients to talk, let alone to admit and apologize, you know, before a case had been finalized. And so they did. And the public defenders, they began to say, wow, this makes sense. It really makes sense. And then a judge heard about it. I talked to a couple of judges, and they said, no, that's not how we do business here. And but then one judge called and said, you know, would you have lunch with me and really tell me how this thing works? And she was sold on it, and she said, you know, I'm going to put together a little training. I ask you to do a couple hour training for four or five of us judges. And
so that gets it into the courts, and I can understand that. What about the public then? Have they come to accept this? Are they aware of it? How much does the public know? And is it something that is considered a success? now?
Well, that's a really good question because people have short-term memory, you know. And right now, in fact, in Des Moines, there's a big push. I'm participating in a big push. The Des Moines Register, which is the state's largest newspaper, is actually beginning a series on juvenile justice and restorative justice. A local organizing group that is under the umbrella of the Saul Alinsky model is taking restorative justice on because we're really at the point now where it's, okay, it's in the system. We know it works. Many, many cases have been dealt with in this way. But now it's a matter of saying, you know what, restorative justice is important enough to be a social movement, just in the way that civil rights was and the feminist movement, you know, the right to vote. And so we're ratcheting it up just as we speak, really. I've been meeting with judges recently and other people and saying we've got to take this out big time to the general public.
We don't have this in the adult system yet here in most of North Carolina, but it is present in the juvenile system. We're talking about restorative justice. And earlier this week, we met with John Powell, an attorney and law professor at Campbell University Law School, a man who started a clinic to apply the practice in the schools to help keep kids out of the adult system. Joining us now to talk more about that is Karen Hamilton. She's Senior Director of Counseling and Student Services in Wake County Schools. Karen, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Is restorative justice, how is restorative justice used in the Wake County system?
Well, the way it's playing out right now is we are running mediation programs in five schools. We're hoping to expand that by three for this school year. And it plays out a little bit differently in every school that uses it's really not a program, uses the practices that are associated with that, and it kind of adjusts itself for the culture of the school.
And how does it work? What sort of offenses are applied, or where? When do you apply this?
That's a good question.
Yes, but very poorly asked. Go ahead.
It's really not applied towards specific offenses. The way that we're using mediation, the portion when I listened to John talk earlier this week, he was really very forthcoming about us using mediation. And the way that plays out in a school is we embed it in the practice of positive behavior support. So how are we trying to shape the culture of the school to look at students who may be offending or possibly getting ready to offend by engaging in talking with each other and talking smack to each other is really what they're doing, and catching that before it actually happens. And that's specific to each school.
So in the past, these kids would have been just plain thrown out of school or suspended and perhaps expelled. Now there's a process. How does it work? I know you've had some pretty remarkable success, at least in one school, where there's been a big turnaround in suspensions.
Sure. When I was talking with folks getting ready for today, by and large, everybody said that they love this. They love the opportunity to engage in mediation. And the reason they like it is it allows them to get in front of offenses before they're actually happening. So we're not punishing kids for things that they've already engaged in. Once we catch wind that there's some conflict between children, it gives us an opportunity to engage in this process. And in one school, we've gone from having over 200 suspensions to 80. Now, it's not we can't say that mediation has really changed all of that, but the processes and the culture for how that school's changed has certainly impacted the number of suspensions in the school.
And the importance of that is that there's a strict correlation between the number of suspensions and your likelihood of coming in contact with the adult criminal justice system when you get out of school.
Yes.
So the more we can keep kids in school, but as you say, the problem for schools is safety. That's a key concern, and the way to deal with it had been, if you've caused a problem, if you've been considered a safety risk, out you go. We've got to protect these other kids. That's the only tool we've had. Now there's one that seems to work. And is it effective? Does it actually reduce the amount of violence? Does it make the school a safe place if I've been through this process?
Sure. And we're seeing a shift in culture for all schools, particularly in Wake County. But as we move forward with that, I think the reason that it works is it allows schools to think of other ways to help maintain safety. And safety is a huge issue. We all want kids to go to safe schools. So it allows us another way to think about how can we offer options to children rather than just preventing them from being in school.
So, Marcia Owen, what is the progress? Where is restorative justice here in this area? What would it take to make it one of the tools in the criminal justice toolkit?
Well, I think we're at the beginning, And I think we're in a dialogue understanding what the principles are. And in understanding those and embracing those thoroughly, the practices will be revealed. I enjoyed your comments, Karen. I got a call from a teacher just to illustrate victim and offenders and how that there were two girls at a high school. One had been taunted for a very long time by a very quiet young woman, and she broke one day and attacked the girl who had been abusing her. Well, she became, of course, the offender. Mm-hmm. So I think that we're at the beginning. I know that if there's any town in this country that is perfect for this, it is Durham. We have enlightened, forward-thinking, compassionate citizens. We recognize that offenders and victims are neighbors, that we are one community, that our safety depends on our relationships. And so I'm very, very hopeful.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Marcia Owen, Executive Director of the Religious Coalition for Nonviolent Durham. Karen Hamilton is the Senior Director of Counseling and Student Services at Wake County Schools. Fred Van Loo is Director of the Center for Restorative Justice Practices, a former prosecutor based in Des Moines, Iowa. Thank all of you for being on the program. Coming up next, a master of the instrument gets ready for a weekend of banjo at UNC. Riley Bogus is with us live on the State of Things. Stay tuned.